Welcome to Hour 1 of the Arizona Republic for August 12th. I'm your volunteer reader, Jack Palmer. In this hour, we'll be reading headlines, Valiant State, and USA Today headlines. The first article is titled, Trump Sending Troops into Nation's Capital, written by Joey Garrison, Tom Vandenbroek, Sibel Mays Osterman, and Josh Meyer. President Donald Trump said he would deploy 800 National Guard troops to Washington and take federal control of the city's police department as part of an aggressive federal effort to crack down on crime in the nation's capital. I'm announcing a historic action to rescue our nation's capital from crime, bloodshed, bedlam, and squalor, and worse, Trump said August 11th, from the White House briefing room, flanked by Attorney General Pam Bondi and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. This is Liberation Day in D.C., and we're going to take our capital back. Trump signed two executive orders earlier in the day. One invoked Section 740 of Washington, D.C.'s Home Rule Act to allow the Trump administration to take control of the Metropolitan Police Department. Separately, he signed a presidential memorandum directing Hegseth to deploy National Guard troops in Washington and authorizing him to coordinate with governors to utilize their state's National Guards as well. Hegseth said the D.C. National Guard was mobilizing that morning at Trump's direction and will be led by Secretary of the Army Daniel Driscoll. You'll see them flowing into the streets of Washington in the coming weeks, Hegseth said, adding the Pentagon is also prepared to bring in additional National Guard units and other specialized units if needed. This is nothing new for DOD, he added, pointing to Trump's deployment of 10,000 military troops at the U.S.-Mexico border to crack down on illegal immigration. The District of Columbia is a federal enclave under jurisdiction of the federal government. The District of Columbia Home Rule Act of 1973 gave the city local governance, including an elected mayor and city council. Trump, on August 11th, declared a public safety emergency in Washington, announcing that Bondi would take command of the Metropolitan Police Department, with new DEA Administrator Terry Cole serving as interim federal commissioner, citing Section 740 of the Home Rule Act, which allows the president to direct the D.C. mayor to deploy local police for federal purposes during emergencies. Trump seemed to suggest that he could later pursue federal intervention to combat crime in places like Chicago and Los Angeles. We're not going to lose our cities over this, Trump said, as he railed against what he called rising crime rates. And this will go further. We're starting very strongly with D.C., and we're going to clean it up real quick, very quickly. Trump said he will make the appropriate notifications to Congress and Washington Mayor Muriel Bowser about the moves. A spokesman for Bowser declined to comment ahead of Trump's press conference. Later on August 11th, during a press conference, Bowser described Trump's federal crackdown as unsettling and unprecedented, while also indicating she will cooperate with federal authorities. On August 10th, Trump posted on social media that the homeless in D.C. have to move out immediately, and at the August 11th press conference said his administration had already begun removing people from parks, underpasses, and other public spaces. He did not explain how the removals would be carried out or where the unhoused would be located, only stating they would no longer be allowed to turn the Capitol into a wasteland for all the world to see. Trump first ordered an increased law enforcement presence on August 8th, resulting in the deployment of 450 officers from 18 agencies, the FBI, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and Secret Service, to high-traffic areas and other hotspots over the weekend. Trump's actions followed the high-profile assault of a staffer from Trump's Department of Government Efficiency, 19-year-old Edward Korestein, that occurred in the early morning hours of August 3rd during an attempted carjacking. The White House pointed to several other examples of violent crime in Washington this year, including the May 21st fatal shooting of two Israeli embassy staffers outside a downtown museum. The suspect is from Chicago. Despite Trump's claims of rising crime and violence in Washington, the Justice Department announced in January the total violent crime for 2024 was down 35% from the year before. In fact, crime in the Capitol is the lowest it has been in over 30 years, according to data collected by the Metropolitan Police Department and included in a January 3rd statement by Washington, D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office. Then U.S. Attorney Matthew Graves, an appointee of former President Joe Biden, credited the decline to a focus on the drivers of violence, those gangs or crews of people who are dealing drugs, protecting turf, committing carjackings, and other robberies, all while armed. During an August 10th appearance on MSNBC's The Weekend, Bowser pushed back at Trump's claims of rising crime in Washington. "We are not experiencing a crime spike," the mayor said. Bowser expressed concern about sending the National Guard into the Capitol, noting that Guard troops are not meant to enforce local laws. "I'm concerned about them not being used efficiently, and I just think that's not the most efficient use of our Guard," Bowser said. "But that's the president's call about how to deploy the Guard." Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois called the president's press conference political theater and an attempt to distract America. His idea of federalizing the police force of D.C. ignores the reality. They're making dramatic progress in reducing violent crime in D.C., so it's a typical move by this president to create chaos and uncertainty and to draw the attention from other issues like Jeffrey Epstein and his papers, Durbin said during a press event for Texas State House Democrats who are boycotting a Trump-backed push to redraw congressional districts. The next article is titled, "Inquiry of Mesa Rangers Closes." No criminal charges will be filed against any member of a rogue group of park rangers who called themselves the Goon Squad after a nearly four-month-long criminal investigation conducted by Mesa Police, records show. Two prosecutors' offices reviewed recommendations for two different charges, and neither thought the evidence presented would lead to a conviction. Mesa investigators have closed their probe, which launched on April 11th, into allegations of criminal activity and wrongdoing, including using racial slurs and targeting homeless people, police spokesperson John Dreyer confirmed to the Arizona Republic. The investigation began after allegations that a group of park rangers had possession of a stolen firearm, used racial slurs and inappropriate use of force, and shared a Goon Squad patch. The detectives uncovered incidents of rangers targeting homeless individuals, seizing drugs, and coining the phrase gooning to mean dealing with the homeless problem. Detectives reviewed nearly 170 cases involving park rangers, four of which were investigated further for potential criminal misconduct, according to Mesa police. The department confirmed that one of those four cases was recommended for a misdemeanor assault charge in May. The Mesa City prosecutor turned it down in June. The Maricopa County Attorney's Office reviewed a recommendation for a charge of possession of a stolen firearm. One ranger was arrested on suspicion of that charge, but county prosecutors declined to charge him two separate times. The county attorney's office decided against charging the first time. Police investigators continued to conduct interviews, review evidence, and execute search warrants. Police handed over the new evidence for review and possible charging. The county attorney's office declined to change its stance on the recommended charges, which were initially filed in April, according to Dreyer. In a report dated July 2nd, a Mesa detective wrote, "There is no further lead or evidence to follow up with." Since Mesa police launched their investigation, at least seven park rangers were placed on leave or resigned, including a second ranger who quit in May. The departures made up half of the 16-person team. The city put the park ranger program under the Mesa Police Department's supervision in April. Mesa also launched a second investigation to look into the personnel misconduct claims uncovered by the criminal investigation. The city's outside counsel took charge. That external investigation into the Rangers unit is nearing its end, and a report should be available in the coming weeks, according to Anna Pereira, a city spokesperson. Newly released police supplemental reports provide additional detail on the accusations against the park rangers. The Republic obtained the reports through a public records request. One of the four cases involving rangers that was further reviewed for potential criminal misconduct included an incident on June 17, 2024. A police report described a Mesa officer witnessing a park ranger chasing a homeless man, tackling him, and placing the man in handcuffs. The man sustained injuries when he was tackled, the police report stated. Two park rangers, the man who was handcuffed and a woman who was involved in the altercation, were interviewed by the police officer. His report stated that a woman had called 911 stating that park rangers in the Pioneer Park bathroom were in a fight and that she could hear a loud struggle happening. The two rangers said they had walked into the bathroom and found a man and a woman inside a stall with their pants down and drug paraphernalia on the floor. The rangers said they separated the man and woman and questioned the man, made him empty his pockets, and told him to leave the park, the report said. The man said a ranger had slammed his head against the wall, according to the police report. That ranger denied to the officer that he had touched or hit the man. The man told the rangers he wasn't leaving the park because his girlfriend was still in the restroom, the report stated. He got into a verbal argument with the second ranger as he was exiting the restroom, which led to the chase. As the man ran out, he asked a bystander to call the police. The man told police he was homeless. He told the officer the ranger who tackled him choked him and slammed his head on the ground, according to the report. The individual had a small abrasion and swelling on his right eyebrow and a minor abrasion and bleeding on the back of his head, according to a police report. A detective was assigned to review the case in May as part of the police department's investigation into potential criminal misconduct involving park rangers. The detective attempted to locate and interview the man who was tackled, but was unable to find him. The woman who was the man's girlfriend at the time was interviewed on May 15th. She told the detective she was tossed by a ranger into a separate stall and told to lift up her bra so the ranger could check if she was hiding drugs. The other ranger was the one who tackled her boyfriend, she said. It was just uncomfortable that they can do that in a restroom, she told the detective. The report stated the two rangers were aggressive and used physical control toward the man and woman. The detective said the ranger stated he chased the man for being verbally disruptive and for refusing to leave the park. These reasons alone do not give park rangers any authority to detain or arrest, the detective wrote. The ranger had no lawful authority to chase and tackle the man, so the detective recommended a charge. City prosecutors declined the misdemeanor assault charge because, at the time, a city ordinance enabled park rangers to eject individuals from the park. That language has since been removed, the city prosecutor wrote. Former park ranger Joshua Amato had seized a gun from an unhoused person in January, kept it in his desk drawer, and never reported it to his supervisor, according to Mesa police. A rookie park ranger reported the gun on April 11th. Mesa police arrested Amato on April 22nd on suspicion of possession of the stolen gun, but the Maricopa County Attorney's Office turned down the charges due to no reasonable likelihood of conviction. The city was in the process of firing Amato before he resigned from the position hours before his termination hearing on April 28th. Interviews included in the newly released police reports showed an attempt by Amato and two other rangers to mislead detectives on how he obtained the firearm. Police served search warrants to city offices and for cell phone data. A day after Amato was arrested, one ranger followed up with police on April 23rd. He told police he remembered that after police confiscated the stolen firearm on April 11th, he saw Amato speaking with Brandon Montez, discussing how they should tell investigators the gun was purchased off the Craigslist website. When the ranger heard Amato and Montez discuss their idea, he told them that would be a stupid thing to do, the police report said. In the same week, the ranger received a phone call from Ranger Charles Miller. The ranger was under the impression that Charles Miller wanted him to say something specific about the firearm, but he stated he was going to be honest with police, according to the report. Montez and Miller were placed on administrative leave pending the city investigation. The weapon came into Amato's possession in January after he found it in a man's backpack. Police interviewed the man on April 26th. The man told police he was homeless and had been sleeping in a bathroom stall at Pioneer Park. Two rangers walked into the bathroom in uniform and another in plain clothing who identified himself as a park ranger supervisor. As he attempted to leave the bathroom, the uniformed ranger pushed him back into the stall, causing him to fall back down onto the toilet, he told detectives. Rangers looked through his bag and gave him two options. They could call the police and have him arrested for the drugs they found in the backpack, or let them confiscate it. He let the rangers keep it. The stolen gun was not mentioned by the man during the police interview, according to the report. Days after police launched their criminal investigation, investigators searched the Rangers' city office on April 28th. Police found four pellet guns that resembled real firearms. Rangers told police the pellet guns were used for training, and at least one was seized from a transient, according to the report. The police also requested access to cell phone data from Amato, Montez, Miller, and Park Ranger Supervisor Brett Burton, who also was placed on leave. Photos of the stolen tan Canik handgun that was in Amato's possession from January were saved on Miller's phone, as well as the drugs he seized in January from the homeless man in Pioneer Park. Police also found numerous photos of other individuals and various drug seizures. The report stated it was unclear what happened to the drugs or other paraphernalia that were seized by Rangers after December 24th. Investigators were unable to locate any forms documenting seized items. An audio recording pulled from Amato's phone criticized the Ranger enforcement changes. According to the report, he stated that they came to work knowing it was time to bash some heads in at Pioneer Park, but now they were in a maintenance mode and he couldn't do that anymore. Mesa police had recommended felony theft charges for the firearm in April to the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. The Attorney's Office declined the charges due to no reasonable likelihood of conviction, it told the Republic in April. New documents give clarity to that decision. Serena Pokras, with the department, wrote that the charge was more of a policy violation than a felony due to lack of intent. She wrote in a letter to Mesa police that there wasn't any evidence that Amato ever took the firearm home, claimed it to be his own, or otherwise intended to keep the firearm for himself. The actions indicated he was negligent in his duties, which did not amount to criminal intent, she wrote. With the criminal and city investigations, the remaining Mesa Park Rangers have not resumed their usual activities. Nine other park rangers remain active under the supervision of the Mesa Police Department. Their current duties include opening and closing selected city parks and amenities, said Pereira, the city spokesperson. The rangers are undergoing extensive training of the policies, procedures, and code of conduct of the Mesa Police Department and performing other administrative tasks as needed, she said. After the external investigation was completed, there would be an assessment for redeployment into Mesa Parks, she said. The next article is titled, Israel Steps Up Bombing in Gaza City. Palestinians reported the heaviest bombardment in weeks on April 11th in areas east of Gaza City, just hours after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he expected to complete a new expanded offensive against Hamas fairly quickly. An airstrike also killed six journalists, including prominent Al Jazeera correspondent Anas al-Sharif, in a tent at Gaza City's Al-Shifa hospital compound, the deadliest strike against journalists during an Israeli campaign that has lasted more than 22 months. Witnesses said Israeli tanks and planes pounded Sabra, Zitoun, and Sharjah, three eastern suburbs of Gaza City in the north of the territory, on August 11th, pushing many families westward from their homes. Some Gaza City residents said it was one of the worst nights in weeks, raising fears of military preparations for a deeper offensive into their city, which Hamas says is now sheltering about 1 million people after the displacement of residents from the enclave's northern edges. The Israeli military said its forces fired artillery at Hamas militants in the area. There was no sign on the ground of forces moving deeper into Gaza City as part of the newly approved Israeli offensive, which was not expected to begin in the coming weeks. "It sounded like the war was restarting," said Amer Salah, 25 years old. "Tanks fired shells at houses, and several homes were hit, and the planes carried out what we call fire rings, whereby several missiles landed on some roads in eastern Gaza," he told Reuters via a chat app. The Israeli military said its forces on August 10th dismantled a launch site east of Gaza City, which Hamas used to fire rockets toward Israel communities across the border. Netanyahu, on August 10th, said he had instructed the Israeli military to speed up plans for the new offensive. "I want to end the war as quickly as possible, and that is why I have instructed the Israel Defense Forces to shorten the schedule for seizing control of Gaza City," he said. Netanyahu said the new offensive would focus on Gaza City, which he described as Hamas's capital of terrorism. He also indicated that the coastal area of central Gaza may be next, saying Hamas militants have been pushed there too. The new plans have raised alarm abroad, with French President Emmanuel Macron saying on August 11th they heralded a disaster of unprecedented gravity and a move towards a never-ending war. He also proposed an international coalition under a United Nations mandate to stabilize Gaza. Macron said the UN mission should be tasked with securing the Gaza Strip, protecting civilians, and working in support of unspecified Palestinian governance. He said the UN Security Council should work on establishing the mission. "I have asked my teams to work on that with our partners without delay," he added. On August 8th, Germany, a key European ally, announced it would halt exports of military equipment to Israel that could be used in Gaza. Britain and other European allies urged Israel to reconsider its decision to escalate the Gaza military campaign. Mike Huckabee, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, told Reuters that some countries appeared to be putting pressure on Israel rather than on Hamas, whose deadly attack on Israel on October 7, 2023, ignited the war. Israel's planned offensive coincides with worsening hunger in Gaza. On August 11th, the territory's health ministry said five more people had died of malnutrition and starvation in Gaza in the past 24 hours. That raised the number of deaths from such causes to 222, including 101 children since the war began, the ministry said. Israel says it has scaled up the entry of aid and commercial goods into Gaza in past weeks. Palestinian and UN officials say the aid is a fraction of what Gaza needs. Medics at Al-Shifa Hospital said the airstrike that killed Al Jazeera's Al-Sharif and four of his colleagues also killed local freelancer Mohammed Al-Khaladi, raising the number of dead journalists from the strike to six. Israel confirmed it had targeted and killed Al-Sharif, alleging he had headed a Hamas cell and was involved in rocket attacks against Israel. Al Jazeera rejected the claim, and before his death, Al-Sharif had also dismissed Israeli allegations that he had links to Hamas. Hamas, the militant group which has run Gaza since 2007, linked his killing to the new planned offensive. The UN Human Rights Office on August 11th condemned the journalist's killings, saying the actions by Israel's military represented a grave breach of international humanitarian law. The Hamas-run Gaza Government Media Office said 238 journalists have been killed in almost 2 years of war. The Committee to Protect Journalists said at least 186 journalists have been killed. Hamas-led fighters triggered the war in October 2023 when they stormed into Israel, killing 1,200 people and taking 251 hostages by Israeli tallies. About 50 hostages are still in Gaza, but only around 20 are thought to be alive. More than 61,000 Palestinians have since been killed by Israel's campaign, according to Gaza health officials. Most of Gaza's population has been displaced multiple times, and its residents are facing a humanitarian crisis, with much of the territory reduced to rubble. You're listening to Hour 1 of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Jack Palmer, and we'll continue with an article titled, New Phoenix Police Chief Committed to Transparency. Matt Giordano's first day as head of the department was August 11th, and in a video, he said he was committed to leading with integrity, humility, and transparency, and he believes in a department that protects and connects. Giordano began his career in Phoenix. He worked there for 23 years until 2017 when he retired as a commander. He went on to serve as the executive chief enforcement for the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office under Paul Penzone, and then as an executive director of the Arizona Peace Officer Standards and Training Board. For months, Phoenix conducted a nationwide search to find a new permanent chief. Giordano was selected in July, about 3 months after the city initially planned to have a new chief. "It's a privilege to lead the Phoenix Police Department at such a pivotal time," said Giordano in a statement. "I'm committed to building trust with our community, supporting our officers, and ensuring we deliver effective, accountable, and compassionate policing." Giordano added he knows the challenges the department faces, but that there are dedicated people who work there, and they will all work to make Phoenix safer. In June 2024, the U.S. Department of Justice released a report on the department and the city. It found the department had widespread issues. Officers routinely used excessive force, discriminated against people of color, and violated the rights of protesters and people experiencing homelessness. The Trump administration closed the investigation and rescinded its findings in May. At a community forum in June, Giordano and the other finalists for the chief position said Phoenix police had made positive changes in response to the federal probe and that they would work to build on these improvements within the department. The next article is entitled, Several Injured in Pennsylvania Steel Plant Explosion, written by Melina Khan, Jorge Ortiz, and Phaedra Trethin. One person was killed, 10 were injured and one remained missing following what Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro said were multiple explosions August 11th at a steel plant in Clairton, Pennsylvania. Allegheny County Emergency Services and the Allegheny County Police confirmed the death at the U.S. Steel Clairton Coke Works plant in a social media statement. Injured employees have now been transported to local hospitals to receive care, Shapiro said on social media. Fire crews could be seen battling flames as heavy smoke rose from the facility, according to CBS News and other local news reports. The plant is about 20 miles south of Pittsburgh. A second person was initially reported missing. They were found, joining the list of those injured and transported to a local hospital, according to Victor Joseph, Assistant Superintendent of the County Police. U.S. Steel Executive Vice President Scott Bucciso told reporters at an afternoon news conference the plant was stable except for the two structures that were shut down after the 10:50 a.m. explosion. An investigation into the cause of the explosions was beginning amid the search for the remaining missing worker. We think we know the general location of that employee, but we're not 100% sure, Bucciso said. Construction worker Zachary Boudet, who was near the steel plant when the explosion happened, told WAETV in Pittsburgh that it sounded like thunder. It shook my chest. It shook the building. Then we saw the dark smoke rising from the steel mill, he said. The moment of the explosion, followed by large plumes of smoke shooting high in the air, was captured live in video from the Breath Project, a Pittsburgh-based nonprofit that advocates for improvements to air quality in southwestern Pennsylvania. The Allegheny County Department of Health issued a statement saying it was actively monitoring the explosion. Residents within 1 mile of the plant were advised, out of an abundance of caution, to remain indoors, close windows and doors, and set their home cooling units to recirculate. Air quality monitors had not detected levels of toxins above federal standards, the department said. U.S. Senator John Fetterman of Pennsylvania said on social media he went to the plant and gathered information from U.S. Steel and the Steelworkers Union. Air is safe, but remain inside, he said. The Clairton plant is the largest coke manufacturing facility in the country. A coking plant turns coal into coke, which in turn is used to make steel in a blast furnace. Coal is heated without oxygen to temperatures as high as 1,125 degrees Fahrenheit, removing its impurities. It softens, then liquefies. Once re-solidified, the resulting coke is a porous, carbon-heavy material. If you miss any of these articles, you can always listen on demand by going to our website, sunsounds.org, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then On Demand. We'll continue with an article titled, Texas Democrat Battles GOP on Own Turf, written by Rick Jervis. State Representative Richard Pena Raymond, a South Texas Democrat, has spent the past week prowling near empty halls in the Texas state capitol, talking to any Republican lawmaker who would listen, and trying to avert a U.S. Supreme Court showdown. On the nearby House floor, Republican lawmakers maneuvered to try to launch a rare mid-decade redistricting effort. They've drawn up a new map of U.S. House districts that could give the GOP 5 more seats and help the party maintain control of the narrowly divided chamber. Most of Raymond's Democratic colleagues left Texas in an attempt to bust the quorums needed for the legislature to pass the measure. But he stayed behind, trying to cajole, convince, pressure, or plead his way out of the crisis. For Raymond, it's deja vu all over again. In 2003, when Texas Republican lawmakers again tried to redraw districts outside the norms of the once-a-decade process that follows each new census, Raymond was on the redistricting committee and became an ardent voice of the opposition. When the measure passed, he was named as a plaintiff in a lawsuit that ultimately ended up in front of the Supreme Court. This time, he said, the stakes are even higher. 2003 was a big deal. We went through a lot, Raymond, 64 years old, told USA Today from his first floor office at the Capitol. I could see that that was history-making, and what's going on right now will be history-making. The current showdown began when President Donald Trump and White House officials urged Texas Republican leaders to redraw voting maps to add 5 new Republican-friendly seats to the U.S. House of Representatives. State Democrats traveled to Illinois, some even to New York and Massachusetts, to prevent Republicans from reaching the 2/3 quorum in the 150-member legislature needed to conduct business. If Texas Republicans succeed in adding 5 GOP seats to the U.S. House, the Trump-friendly chamber could allow the president to continue one of the most aggressive and disruptive agendas in modern presidential history. A Democratic majority in January 2027 opens the door to congressional investigations, legislative paralysis, even a third impeachment. Governor Greg Abbott has threatened to arrest the absent lawmakers, and the U.S. Justice Department has said it will also try to track down the AWOL representatives. And on August 8th, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton asked the state Supreme Court to oust 13 Democratic lawmakers from office over their absence from the Capitol, arguing they abandoned their seats when they fled the state. The GOP's Texas power play has set off a redistricting arms race as blue state leaders move to create more Democratic-leaning House seats to counter Texas, and lawmakers in other red states, including Indiana and Missouri, consider joining the fray. Vice President J.D. Vance met with Indiana lawmakers on August 7th, reportedly to urge them to redraw maps, and Florida Republican leaders have said they, too, will form a committee to begin redrawing districts. In 2003, Texas Republicans also tried to redraw maps 3 years after census data was released, prompting state Democrats to retreat to a hotel in Oklahoma just over the state line from Texas and out of reach of troopers who could force them to return. Raymond fought the bill in committee, then joined his colleagues in Oklahoma. During committee hearings, he was at times the lone Democrat, objecting to Republican motions and grilling witnesses about the legality and fairness of gerrymandering maps for partisan gain. His goal was to get his comments and questions and their replies on the official record. Lawmakers ultimately approved the new maps, but lawsuits were filed and the case wound up in the U.S. Supreme Court. A 5-4 decision upheld the Texas redistricting plan, but ruled part of it violated the Voting Rights Act by diluting the voting power of Latino voters. A proposal to split Laredo, Raymond's hometown, in half was removed. It was a 50-50 victory, but a victory nonetheless, he said. On August 8th, Raymond walked the short distance from his first-floor office to the second-floor House chamber. He wound his way around desks, chatting with fellow lawmakers, both Democrat and Republican. "There's a saying," he said, "that's popular in the Spanish-speaking border city where he's from. Hablano se entiende, or speaking to each other, you're able to understand each other. I've always tried my whole career to try to talk to everybody, get to know everybody, all 149 other members," he said. "That hasn't changed." Raymond, a state lawmaker since 2001, is one of the more tenured Democrats in the legislature. Known as a moderate, he represents a heavily Latino district that fans out for several square miles from Laredo along the U.S.-Mexico border and is home to about 183,000 residents. Last year, Trump managed a near sweep of Texas border counties, traditionally a Democratic stronghold, winning 14 of the 18 counties on or near the border, including Webb County, which includes Laredo. Trump's wins along the border were the biggest for a presidential candidate in three decades, outpacing those by native Texan George W. Bush when he won the governorship in 2004. The border's shifting allegiances make it politically risky for representatives of those districts to align too closely with national Democratic figures, such as Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker, who is essentially harboring the Texas Democrats, said Mark Jones, a Rice University political scientist. "It's no coincidence," Jones said, "that 5 of the 6 Democrats who stayed behind last week were from border districts in South Texas. Raymond, who is up for re-election next year, also likely prefers to keep his distance," he said. Republicans in Texas appear to be laser-focused on keeping the new redistricting maps unchanged, Jones said, despite the efforts of Raymond or anybody else. "The idea you can stay behind and get maps drawn to be less impactful on Democratic representation is very unlikely," he said. Raymond acknowledged he's faced with a Herculean task. His deepest fear, he said, is that the issue will again end up before the Supreme Court, this time with a court much more malleable to the GOP agenda. "Still, he'll keep trying. When it gets to feel overwhelming," he said, he tries to remind himself that other members equally love their country and state and are trying to make it better. "I recognize that we won't always agree on how we get there, but I don't ever doubt that," Raymond said. "I always start from that common place." The next article is entitled, "General Testifies Risk Was Low at LA Protests." Troops were used to protect federal property and personnel in California in recent months, even though intelligence assessments showed little danger, two military officials testified on August 11th at a trial over President Donald Trump's authority to use soldiers to police American streets. The 3-day non-jury trial before San Francisco-based U.S. District Judge Charles Breyer will determine whether the government violated a 19th-century law that bars the military from civil law enforcement when Trump deployed the troops in June, as the state of California claims in its legal challenge. Los Angeles experienced days of unrest and protests sparked by mass immigration raids at places where people gather to find work, like big hardware stores, a garment factory, and a warehouse. Republican President Trump ordered 700 Marines and 4,000 National Guard troops to Los Angeles in June against the wishes of its Democratic governor, Gavin Newsom. The administration denies the troops were used in civil law enforcement and plans to show that they were protecting federal property and U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents. The trial kicked off hours after Trump said he was taking the extraordinary step of deploying National Guard troops to fight crime in Washington, D.C., and suggested he could take similar measures in other U.S. cities. Federal data shows crime in the city is at a record low. Much of the testimony August 11th came from U.S. Army Major General Scott Sherman, who until recently commanded the military operation in Los Angeles. Under questioning from a lawyer for California, he testified about an internal military intelligence assessment that concluded there would be little risk to federal property and personnel during a July 7th immigration enforcement operation at a Los Angeles park. Sherman said a DHS official criticized him and questioned his loyalty to the country after he denied an initial request for military assistance for the operation. A different request for assistance was later approved by U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, Sherman said. Later, during Sherman's testimony, Breyer asked the general whether the military can deploy troops to incidents even if it has determined there is low risk to federal property or personnel. If it's not seen as a situation in which there is a threat, then it is your testimony you can still deploy the military because there may be a threat in carrying out the operation? Breyer asked. That's correct, Your Honor, Sherman said. The Trump administration's witnesses also described more chaotic situations in which protesters threw Molotov cocktails and damaged federal buildings, justifying the use of the military to protect government property. Many of the troops have been withdrawn from Los Angeles, but California's Attorney General Rob Bonta said on August 11th that 300 National Guard members are still on immigration raids and restricting civilian movements in the state. The Trump administration last week extended the activation of troops in the Los Angeles area through November 6th, according to court filings by Newsom. The federal government deployed military troops to the streets of Los Angeles for the purposes of political theater and public intimidation, Bonta said in a statement. This dangerous move has no precedent in American history. California and Newsom have asked Breyer to prohibit the troops from directly participating in domestic law enforcement activities. They say the National Guard is accompanying ICE agents on raids and assisting in arrests in violation of the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878 and other laws that forbid the U.S. military from taking part in civilian law enforcement. California's lawsuit ultimately seeks a ruling that would return its National Guard troops to state control and a declaration that Trump's action was illegal. The trial before Breyer will have limited impact on Trump's plans to deploy hundreds of National Guard troops to Washington. Unlike in California and other states, where the governor typically decides when to activate Guard troops, the president directly controls the National Guard in Washington. The next article is entitled, Trump Says Russia and Ukraine Both Need to Cede Territory. Written by Trevor Hunnicutt, Steve Holland, Yulia Dysa, and Lily Bayer. President Donald Trump said on August 11th that Kyiv and Moscow will both have to cede land to end the war in Ukraine, and talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin this week will instantly show whether the Kremlin leader is willing to make a deal. European leaders and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky plan to speak with Trump ahead of his summit with Putin in Alaska on August 15th, amid fears Washington may dictate unfavorable peace terms to Ukraine. Trump has hardened his stance toward Moscow by agreeing to allow additional U.S. weapons to reach Ukraine and threatening tariffs against buyers of Russian oil. But fears have persisted in Europe that he might agree to a deal that forces big concessions from Kyiv. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Kaja Kallas said on August 11th that transatlantic unity, support to Ukraine, and pressure on Russia were needed to end the war and prevent future Russian aggression in Europe. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer spoke to his Canadian counterpart Mark Carney, and they welcomed diplomatic efforts to bring peace and agreed that this must be built with Ukraine, not imposed upon it, according to a statement from Downing Street, where UK's Prime Minister resides. Trump told the White House press conference of his talks with Putin that this is really a feel-out meeting. He said he would know probably in the first 2 minutes whether progress was possible. I'm going to be telling him, you've got to end this war, he said. I'm going to go and see the parameters now. I may leave and say, good luck, and that'll be the end. I may say, this is not going to be settled. Trump said a future meeting could include Zelensky, and the U.S. goal is a speedy ceasefire in the bloody 3.5-year-old conflict. He plans to speak to European leaders soon after he talks with Putin. Trump has, in the past, talked about land swaps, but neither Russia nor Ukraine has been open to ceding land as part of a peace deal. Speaking to reporters, Trump said, there'll be some land swapping going on. I know that through Russia and through conversations with everybody, to the good of Ukraine, he said. He said Russia had occupied some very prime territory, but we're going to try to get some of that territory back. And that's all the time we have for this hour of the Arizona Republic. I'm your broadcast volunteer, Jack Palmer. Stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona.